It's the best of the 180s edition of Radio Free Thinker. This time, the skeptic bubble, defining the isms of skepticism, and inclusive or exclusive skepticism. Let's listen to classic Radio Free Thinker.
It's time for Radio Free Thinker, the show that applies skepticism and critical thinking to everyday issues. The place where reason and reality cross swords with politics, religion, economics, and of course, science. Now let's get ready to be skeptical.
The cosmos is also within us. We're made of sparks. We are away. The cosmos can know itself.
Across the sea of space, the stars are others. We've traveled this way before. And there is much to be learned.
Hello and welcome to Radio Free Thinker, the radio show podcast that promotes skepticism and critical thinking right here on CITR 101.9 FM in Vancouver. My name is Ethan, your free thinking historian.
And this is Don, your political science philosopher.
So Ethan, I had an interesting discussion with a not very skeptical friend of mine. We were talking about organ transplants. I mean, this most people probably do over lunch. anyway, he started to talk about how some people have major personality change because of transplants, but not from what you would normally think, you know, as a major life event, but because there is something in the blood or the cells or something that remembers the old host. I told him, of course, why I thought it was a bunch of bunk, but he thought it would be a good topic for the show. Me and my slight arrogance, I replied, you know, that if we ever did a sort of serious segment about cellular memory, as it's called, we'd be laughed off the air because, I mean, why would we even think such a thing was plausible? So I then went to what I consider to be a reliable skeptic resource, Skeptic Dictionary, and without actually reading it myself, I kind of insisted that, you know, he read the part about cellular memory. And yes, I know I can be a bit of an ass at times, but he did read it. He then said, to my surprise, well, see, it says that it's possible, and there are a number of people, studies, theories, and that about the subject that sort of say, hey, it's true and it's plausible. I thought he misread the entry. So I checked it out, and well, for different reasons than you may think, it actually does seem to be somewhat worthy of a segment all unto itself. Now, before you laugh us off the air, it did not actually say that it was plausible or true, but the way it sort of presented the data was, how shall I say, sort of funny and dry-witted, something that would not have conveyed to a true believer what I think was meant as the message or the information in the article. So first, what did it actually say? And brace yourself, some of this I think is going to be funny for our more dyed-in-the-wool skeptics. But, so, from the Skeptic Dictionary, and part of this is going to be paraphrased, part of this will be actually quoting, it sort of starts off by saying, well, you know, the origins of cellular memory are based in the magical thinking of our ancestors. You know, that by eating the heart of some courageous enemy, you'll be given his strength. Some of Chinese or traditional medicine is based upon this sort of sympathetic magic idea. Let us not forget the famous or infamous cure for virility by eating the tiger penis or the rhino horn.
So it goes on these days, actually, endangering the rhino to the point of extinction.
Exactly. It's very sad that this magical thinking still goes on. In fact, actually, you know, the practice of cannibalism is based upon this theory. And yes, Catholics, transubstantiation is, if not real cannibalism, metaphoric cannibalism, so you still are buying into this sort of thinking. Now, of course, it's they go on and they talk about, you know, it's a huge meme in popular culture. You know, you get the arm of a psycho killer and it becomes the basis for some horror movie. How many of us can't forget the time when Homer got his hair transplant and turned into a snake, right? So, I mean, it's prevalent in our culture in a non sort of serious way. Of course, then they go on and they focus on one particular case that and sort of try to provide a rational explanation for it. The case is about Clara Sylvia, who had a heart-lung transplant, who after the transplant had cravings for beer. In her book, she explained her sudden cravings for beer on the notion that her donor, who was an 18-year-old male, died in a motorcycle accident. The implied implication is that young men like beer. She got his heart, now she likes beer because of something that transferred on there. Now, it was at this point when I was reading the skeptic entry, I was expecting to say, well, this is why it's sort of crazy. And then here are some practitioners and why their thoughts are incoherent. But it didn't. So right after that, it started talking about a Dr. Larry Doocy, one of the Oprah alumni, who says, you know, he didn't actually accept cellular memory explanation for Claire's sudden craving for beer. He thought it was most likely an explanation, quote, is that the consciousness of the donor had fundamentally united with the consciousness of the recipient, enabled the recipient to gain information from the donor. Perhaps, he mused, the organ recipient entered a realm of consciousness where information about the another person can be accessed through the universal mind. And the only debunking they had for that was, perhaps, but is there a simpler explanation? And I went, okay, so then we'll go on to the next one. James Van Pro, who again, most skeptics will know in one way or another as a crazy spiritualist. He's quoted by saying, donated organs often come from young people who are killed in car or motorcycle accidents and die quickly. Because their spirit often feels they haven't completed their time on Earth, they sometimes attach themselves to another person. There they essentially make the donor want to complete what the spirit didn't get to do in the first place. Then they go on, the skeptic dictionary says, you know, James gets his information from the spirit world. Unfortunately, there's no way to validate his claim. And again, I'm going, no, there is a great reason to unvalidate this claim.
Well, my question is, like, so suppose I'm killed in a motorcycle accident. How do I decide which organ to latch on to? Because if I take my heart, my lung, my liver, my kidney, you know, do I go with the heart? Because that sounds more cool. But, you know, maybe the lung. Because, like, you know, maybe I want to try skydiving. You know, like, I don't want to give my heart to an old lady who's not going to go skydiving, right? So.
Yeah, well, but you see the midichlorians that are in your bloodstream infest every cell. So, again, it's kind of, there's a little bit of you in everything.
Oh, that's interesting. I wonder if, like, I ever get together with the other me's and meet, hey, have you done skydiving yet? No, not yet. We went to a sewing festival.
Well, what about blood donation, too?
Yeah.
Which, I mean, was mentioned in one of the pop culture references. But So then they go on and they talk about Paul Prosol, who is a PhD, a psychologist and author, goes much further in his speculation that certain cravings are passed from donor to recipient in organ transplants. Prosol claims that the heart has a coded, subtle knowledge connecting us to everything and everyone around us. The heart is a sentient, thinking, feeling being, communicating organ. He claims donated cells remain energetic and non-locally connected to their donor. And of course, the debunking for that particular claim is how he knows this is anybody's guess, which I guess has so far been the best sort of debunking been in there. But again, this explanation in itself, you know, well, first of all, I think it's been almost, 500 years, if not 1,000 years, since we thought the heart was an actual thinking, feeling thing and not just an organ to pump the blood around. And you know, I guess we're going to mention maybe this a little bit later, but we talked about before, you know, this has been all based upon beer craving. Well, is that your major fundamental motivating force? But we'll talk about that a little later. So they actually even had, and I weeped when I saw this. They had some comments about the beliefs of Sylvia Brown and L. Ron Hubbard. And sorry, folks, I just can't bring myself to mention them. But take note that they are mentioned in a non-critical way in the dictionary. Then they talk about Dr. Candace Pert, a professor of the Department of Physiology and Biophysics at Georgetown University, who believes, quote, the mind is just not in the brain, but also exists throughout the body. Dr. Pert is an expert in peptide pharmacology. Quote, the mind and the body communicate with each other through chemicals known as peptides. These are found in the brain as well as in the stomach and all major organs, and these memories can be accessed anywhere in the receptor network. For instance, a memory associated with food may be linked to the liver, and such can be transplanted to one person from one person to another. Of course, they're debunking on this because they do debunking. The evidence for these claims has yet to be produced. I mean, Dr. Pert doesn't explain why we don't seem to be affected by the memories from the animals we eat. Perhaps the peptides get destroyed. Now, that last part was the whole debunking of that. But by mentioning that last thing, why don't we get them from animals, seems to say, well, there's actually a point here that might be true. And here's the reason why our sort of flippant comments about it may not be true.
Well, isn't peptide a type of cake? I seem to recall there was a celluloid peptide cake with mint frosting somewhere.
Yes, yes. Star Trek had a famous episode. But peptides are sort of a complex protein. And again, the fact that this is a person who is a professor, you know, Georgetown University, makes this all sound like supporting evidence. They even go on that Gary Swartz, a doctor, claims that he has 70 cases where he believes transplant patients have inherited the traits of their donor. He believes this because of, quote, the stories are compelling and consistent. He also said that when the organ is placed in the recipient, the information and energy stored in the organ, whatever the hell that is passed on to the patient. The theory applies to any organ that has cells that are interconnected. They could be kidney, liver, or even muscle. And again, I think almost all our cells are in one definition or another interconnected. And if they're not, then they're the virus or bacteria that's trying to eat you. And even it could be said to be connected to you in some way.
If you weren't connected, wouldn't you just fall apart? Like, yeah. That doesn't make any sense.
Which I think was also an episode of Star Trek.
But, yeah, probably.
So again, their debunking of this is Schwartz calls his belief a theory, but is not a theory in the sense that scientists use this term. It would be more accurate to call it an untestable speculative model.
Sorry.
Or
you could call it bullcrap.
Like. Yeah. Now, they do actually come back and they kind of have some goodness at the end of it, where they talk about how collecting stories to validate a hypothesis is a risky business. Stories of transplant patients that don't seem to exhibit memories from their donors don't prove that it's not there. Which, again, seems to imply that there is something there to be gotten.
That's proving a negative in the first place, which is impossible.
Yeah. But then they do go on to say that you can cherry pick any particular result.
Right.
And, you know, you have confirmation bias. They do make a small but point about how confirmation bias can explain why sometimes it seems like they have this connection. The entry ends with this line that I think is probably one of the worst skeptic lines I've ever heard in a, quote, reputable skeptic resource. And I love Skeptic Dictionary. I go to it quite often. But it says, the stories are intriguing and may lead to some serious scientific investigation at some time in the future. Okay, I give them credit. One of the things about being a scientist and all that is to be open to the possibility that there may be more around us than we understand, and that, A, you shouldn't rule out something without sort of having looked at it, and, B, you should acknowledge that whatever you believe now may change in the future, which is, I think, kind of what they're going with this one line. But at the end of it, I couldn't really blame my friend for sitting there thinking, see, even your skeptic dictionary says that this is not a crazy idea, and it's not only quite possible, it's almost probable, because the total absence of sort of, you know, contradictory evidence. Now, there was one other thing that I did think was interesting, and I actually learned two bits from all this, is that in the comment section, they had someone who was real scientist compared to what we've already talked about, that apparently in bone marrow transplants, and please take this with a grain of salt, I didn't have time to confirm this, but I can understand a mechanism that worked. In bone marrow transplants, which are quite different than solid organ transplants, it is possible apparently to affect your immune system, and you can actually pick up things like an allergy, certain kinds of allergies, by doing that. But that's because your bone marrow is your immune system, and it's kind of like if you transplanted the lungs of a smoker into someone who wasn't a smoker, and the person who got the new lungs, or which were damaged lungs, had trouble breathing. Well, you'd expect that, because it is something that is plausible within the context of that.
Yeah.
I also learned, again, just doing a quick thing, that there is something called cellular memory, and this is where you can get kind of confused, because they've done a lot of research more recently in things called slime molds and that. Where slime molds can kind of learn things, and they can kind of remember things, but these are not learning and remembering in the sense that we think about them. It's more, what was it? I was listening to the CBC Quirks and Quarks, and they were talking about how a slime mold can create the best optimized plan for searching for food. And one of the ways it does that is it remembers where it's been. And you go, but it's a single-celled organism. It doesn't have nerves. So, I mean, how can it remember? Well, the cell must have some form of memory, literally. And how that particular works is that when it moves over an area, it leaves a bit of slime behind. And it has a reaction that whenever it says, oh, there's this slime, stay away from the slime. It's a very simple mechanism, but it has this really complex sort of results.
Yeah. Well, I mean, that to me is, it's not so much memory, but it's more of an evolutionary advantage. Like, I don't think if we could go inside the, quote, head of the slime mold, it's not like, oh, slime, I was here before. It's probably like evolution has favored the slime mold that doesn't like to touch its own slime. Has the, secondary effect of making it find better places to eat.
And that's where I got down with this. Because, I mean, ultimately, and I apologize to my friend if he's listening, cellular memory in the context that we were talking about is bullcrap. There's no evidence. It is, I'm going to be a little bit more bolder here, impossible to exist in the way that it has been presented. As in, there is no even a theoretical mechanism for it to work. But that being said, I just, in a knee-jerk reaction, which we shouldn't do, just said, oh, there's this source, trust it no matter what it said, mm-hmm. which I shouldn't have done. I should have checked it out at least peripherally beforehand. And two, I think part of the problem is I'm not quite sure, and maybe Ethan, you can, because you know Skeptic Dictionary to a degree as well, I'm not quite sure whether this was meant for the layperson or the believer, or whether it was meant as a resource for skeptics, so that you would have an understanding of the crazy, so that when you talk to people, you understood what they thought, and then me, as a good skeptic, would go out and I could provide my own counter-arguments to it, and they didn't need to do that.
Yeah. See, that's the thing with Skeptic Dictionary. I like it a lot as well, but sometimes when you look up a pseudoscientific claim, it just summarizes the claim. And so, if you look up, you know, for example, like this one, cellular memory, it'll summarize all the different people who think this is a real thing, and it won't really go into any detail about why what they're saying is wrong. It's just sort of like, here's what they think, which is useful in research because you can go, okay, so James von Prague thinks that, now I know where to start my research. But it's not really good for someone who wants to learn about this. You know, the way Wikipedia is sort of set up, if you look up, you know, the War of 1812, it explains the War of 1812. It doesn't just say, these are the people who believe the War of 1812 happened, you know?
Right.
And I mean, like you said, you can go through this article and debunk it pretty simply. I mean, most of these people are proposing an explanation that can't be verified or tested in any way, and the mechanism to create the effect can't be tested or verified. It might as well be magic. So right then and there, you're kind of going, well, okay, you know, if we can't test it, we can't see it, experience it, what's the difference from saying that it doesn't even exist in the first place?
And that goes in with the whole idea of the bubble, which you get much more in politics, but, I mean, you can get this in skepticism and in-group versus out-group. Because, I mean, as you heard, I mean, we went through this all, we laughed at parts. There was the debunking they did in it, I mean, the one line or so, I mean, it was more a joke. I mean, it was more like, ha, that's stupid, but, you know, it wasn't debunking. And in that sort of sense, and again, my first reaction sort of said, wow, maybe I am in a bit of a bubble, and I don't realize that people who don't believe what I believe, or who don't have the scientific method, who don't know the resources I have, for them, what seems to me a completely silly and stupid argument isn't, because they don't have this connection. They don't live in the bubble. They live in a different kind of bubble.
Yeah. Well, the other thing that this sort of does, for someone who doesn't know the background of science, this is a very good example of a Gish Gallop of, like, oh, look at all these impressive names who have PhDs and who study at prestigious universities. They all think this, ergo, it must be true. You know, I mean, there's very few, for example, evolutionary biologists who will say, well, listen, evolution is true because of Richard Dawkins and Charles Darwin and James, you know, all these other people. That's not really an argument to base anything on, right? And when they're saying things like, you know, Swartz calls his belief a, quote, theory, but it's not a theory in the sense that scientists use the term, well, they don't explain the term theory in science. I mean, that's a really important point, and they don't expand on that.
Well, and actually, there wasn't even a hyperlink. I was expecting a hyperlink or something, right? Because, I mean, you could say, well, we don't have the time, but you know, and of course, and this is where I think I do this, I think, on occasion, is that I think, ooh, this sounds really impressive, so I'm going to use this term. An untestable speculative model. Now, okay, I kind of know enough about science to understand what they mean by untestable, speculative, and model. But someone looks at that and says, oh, those are big words, right? And so I guess they're just saying that it's a model. It somehow describes the world. And they don't quite grab the idea that untestable and speculative are much more negative connotations in science than they would be as in, well, we're not really sure. This is a possible idea for an answer, which is what I think a common sense view would say. Well, we're not sure yet, but it's not so negative as it would be in a scientific context.
Well, I mean, it's a good way sort of to bookend the show, because we were talking about the perils of communicating science with regards to the Italian scientists who were convicted of manslaughter. And this is another good example where terminology that we're familiar with, that we understand and take for granted, is not terribly easy to understand for a layperson. I mean, I can't even count how many times I've had an argument with somebody about some pseudoscientific thing, and I'll say a jargony skeptic term, and they'll look at me like I'm crazy. And it's really easy to fall into that trap. So we have to be really good at explaining ourselves, and explaining ourselves in a way that the public, who has no background on what we're talking about, understands what we mean. And when you say a speculative, untested model, what that really means is it's not testable, it might as well be false, and it hasn't been proven in any real way.
Well, speculative in this context is a guess.
Yeah.
Right? An untestable guess.
Yeah.
So
I mean, like, it's akin to saying, you know, every 5 seconds the universe doubles in size.
Does it?
Well, it could. It's totally unspeculable.
Yes, and perhaps to lead us to something that, because again, we're kind of still talking in the bubble, but quite often people will sit there and they will hear about quantum and how that term has been so misused in the universe as a whole. I'll say the universe because it's probably misused somewhere else. You know, people will say, well, quantum, I hear in the news that quantum connect two particles across a great distance. And this guy says, well, that means that my brain and your brain are somehow connected across a great distance. And that's the level of a lot of people's knowledge and understanding, because we live in a complex society and all that. And we often will forget that we are a bit of nerds when it comes to a lot of this particular information, and that there is, in a certain degree, a second level of onus to make sure that when we try and convey our skepticism, we do it with an understanding of the person we're talking to doesn't have the same word set or knowledge set that we do. And again, when I started this discussion with him, I thought I was just being normal. But when I started writing down this segment, I went, well, you know, from his perspective, I'm an ass.
Yeah. I've actually, believe it or not, people have told me that I can be kind of annoying sometimes.
I find that totally believable. I mean, unbelievable. Unbelievable.
Yeah, sure you do.
Well, you know, this might be a good point to take a bit of a pause.
Science is the best tool ever devised for understanding how.
To subscribe to the Radio Free Thinker podcast and take it on the go and download previous episodes, subscribe via iTunes or at radiofreethinker.com. Remember to like us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter at CITRRFT. If you have any questions, comments, or thoughts to share with us, email at info@radiofreethinker.com. Okay, and we're back. So there's been a lot of discussion of isms and all this terminology. So Don, tell us a little bit about what are these terms that we use, atheism, skepticism, humanism, what do they mean? Why do we use them? What's the point?
Yes, well, I guess I should preface this by saying that in order to have a rational discussion, and in philosophy, definitely so, you need to kind of have a definition of the terms you're using. Now, I'm not going to be, you know, the God definer here and say that what I'm defining is the absolute right way to do it, but I want people to know that when I start talking about these particular topics, this is how I define them. You may disagree with my definition, but you know what I'm talking about, even if you would want to change the word. So one of the big ones that's been big in the community lately, and I mean, a lot of this has come out because, you know, the there's been debates about atheism, skepticism, humanism, socialism, and words they've attached to it, waves and pluses and such. So what do these words sort of mean? So atheism is essentially a belief system about the existence or non-existence of a supernatural entity. One can be an atheist simply because you've never been exposed to any religion. Equally, you could be agnostic. That's what I would call a weak atheist, because you think, you know, the question is sort of beyond a certainty of knowledge, best left answered as I don't know. Some will be atheists because of sort of a contradiction of theory and practice. I'm sure a number of Catholics, for example, lost their faith because they couldn't reconcile sort of a loving God / church and pedophilic priests. I think I would count someone like Ian Harris Ali, one of our awful atheists from episode 177, in this category. And of course, there are those who look at the evidence and conclude that there is no scientific or weight of evidence to believe. Now, of course, you could be an atheist for several or all of these reasons, but that's roughly how I see, you know, atheism. Skepticism is quite different in many ways. Skepticism to me isn't so much a belief, but a theory of knowledge. It's not so much, as I say, belief in itself, but a mechanism for selecting beliefs, for truths, for facts. The original philosophical skeptics questioned if knowledge was possible for humans, that humans could actually make any kind of truth claim. And if you think about sort of the Matrix, you know, how do you know that you're not a brain in a jar sort of thing? And philosophically, you know, you couldn't say anything with certainty. Now, of course, this was based on a very strong logical foundation. Although it was very strong and there was a lot of certainty sort of in its uncertainty, there's a certain pragmatic sense where you kind of want to bite the bullet and assert something and then build your picture of the world upon this.
It pragmatically fell apart, basically.
Essentially. I mean, it was good, but it didn't carry much weight. So then you would have sort of the, you know, what I call theistic or rational skeptics. Those are people like Thomas Aquinas and Descartes, who, I mean, I disagree with some of their conclusions, but they're actually, they moved us beyond sort of the ancient skeptics. So they sort of accepted the logic of the ancients, but acknowledged that a rejection of any knowledge seemed sort of irrational. So choosing to take a pragmatic route, they needed to add to their world a foundation, a rational rock upon which to build knowledge. Now, of course, they chose to chose God as their foundation. And it wasn't really until you had like Francis Bacon and the scientific revolution of the Enlightenment that scientific skepticism even became possible. So scientific skepticism has its foundations in the scientific method. When combined with logic and reason, we get a powerful sort of self-correcting tool to filter competing ideas from the world around us. Are you still with me, Ethan?
Yeah, I'm on board with that. Although, I mean, I get a little bit prickly when people mention Aquinas and Descartes as skeptics, but nevertheless.
Well, yeah, maybe we'll debate that after I finish my little list here. So humanism is essentially a philosophy about how we should treat ourselves and our fellow humans. Its foundation is largely Epicurean in nature, which essentially said that, you know, humans are the best measure of good, and that through moderation and education, we become the best judges of good. There is sort of a rejection of the supernatural or otherworldliness as our masters. Humanism in the Renaissance could be compatible with religious beliefs. Modern secularism, of course, sort of presupposes atheism, although belief in an impersonal deity is possible. For example, Neil Armstrong's deists could be a secular humanist. There isn't really a logical incompatibility with that. Secular humanism, of course, attempts to move beyond atheism in the sense that it's trying to provide an ethical framework in a sort of post religious society. I mean, atheism essentially denies a supernatural deity. Humanism sort of comes in and says, well, then how should we build a ethical, moral society? So the context, in a modern context, though, we've actually had more of a focus on the secular as opposed to the humanism, because in the sense that they're trying to remove religion from the public forum. In this form, humanism often finds itself allied with things like Unitarians and other sort of secular religious movements who see faith as more personal and not a public exercise. Still on board?
Well, yeah, definitely. I mean, I've heard the argument that modern day secular humanism sort of precludes the modern day secular humanism assumes atheism on the part of the participant. I'm skeptical of that claim, to mix metaphors. and part of the reason is because, you know, I've been fairly involved in the sort of organized route of skepticism humanism, and I've encountered a lot of humanists who flat out reject the notion that you need to be an atheist to be a humanist. And I've encountered it enough times that I would say that it's not, I wouldn't even say that the majority of quote unquote secular humanists are atheists. Now, I mean, people are free to disagree with me on that, and I will fully accept that it's just an anecdote, but that's my personal take on it, at least.
Well, you know, it's funny, actually, right outside my SkyTrain station is a building that is the Buddhist humanism, the sort of society, you know, and I think one of the things is that there are the humanist movement itself, in attempting to create the big tent, has sort of lowered its requirements for admission, so to speak. I think, you know, they say, well, if you agree with us that there shouldn't be any religion in government, that your belief system is your belief system and shouldn't be pushed on anyone else, you acknowledge that science is science, and you know, there's a certain number of criteria that are not necessarily contradictory to a lot of people's religious beliefs, that they will let you into their tent. And in that sense, you know, they're trying to build upon. But again, it makes what technically is secular humanism not really applicable to the humanist movement as we see it now. Sorry, Ian, you're going to write in and yell at me for saying that, and you might have a chance to rebuttal if you wish.
Well, I mean, he may have a point. And the thing is, too, though, I mean, like, we sometimes forget that the humanism began as a very religious movement, and that it was about reforming religion. I mean, I wrote about this myself in a blog post on Skeptic North. Humanism turned religion around. I mean, religion was a very top-down, do what we say or we will burn you mentality. Humanism, and you can argue whether it was successful, really started to turn religion into that kind of, you know, religion is about peace and love and faith and camaraderie and all this, you know, hoity-toity BS. Humanism was sort of, it defanged a lot of the vitriol that existed in religion. I mean, now that has, of course, regained a lot of momentum with the rise of fundamentalism and whatnot. But humanism was, in many ways, a very tempering force in the early or the late Renaissance and eventually onto the Enlightenment. I mean, humanism was what you called yourself if you didn't think you should burn somebody alive. Like, that was an important factor of humanism, right?
Yeah, actually, and this will tie into another one of the isms that I'm writing about, but maybe is a bit of a horseshoe into this, is the idea of socialism. Now, socialism, again, is sort of a belief that strength and prosperity is more completely attained through social cooperation. Socialists to this day come from all points of the religious spectrum. Unlike the other isms we discussed, socialism isn't so much individualistic, but it sort of presupposes a groupthink attitude that one could be individually an atheist, skeptic, or even a humanist, but you couldn't be a singular and socialist at the same time. That would make you a libertarian. And I think maybe that's one of the areas where humanism has crossroads with a lot of the or has potential on other things, is it is a lot about the we instead of the I. And I think a lot of the other movements tend to get I first and we second.
Well, I've heard from many people when I attend conferences and whatnot, skeptic, humanist, or otherwise, that the vibe that I often hear from people is that the I hate using these kind of terminology, that organized skepticism and that it is different from organized humanism is that the skeptic movement is more right-wing and the humanism movement is more left-wing. Now, I don't really buy that, but I have heard that again many times from people that skepticism is more has a more libertarian bent than humanism does.
Well, you know, this might be a good point to take a bit of a pause, go have a coffee, take a deep breath, and when we come back, we'll talk about the new direction of atheism or skepticism, however you choose to parse it, when we come back.
Standing on a planet, really I'm just a speck, compared with a star.
Radio Free Thinker is broadcast Tuesdays at 3:30 p.m. on CITR 101.9 FM in Vancouver. You can also hear us Mondays at 8 a.m. on UMFM 101.5 FM in Winnipeg, Fridays at 3 p.m. on CFBX 92.5 FM in Kamloops, and Saturdays at 9 a.m. on CKXU 88.3 FM in Lethbridge. Our thanks to all the stations that broadcast Radio Free Thinker and help promote skepticism and critical thinking. If you would like to have Radio Free Thinker syndicated on your local station, please email us at info@radiofreethinker.com.
We've traveled this way before, and there is much to be learned.
Okay, and we're back. Now, I've kind of given you a rough definition. We've kind of stressed out some of the ism words that will be thrown around. But there's been a lot of talk about things like atheism plus and the fourth wave skepticism. Ethan, you've done a bit more research into this, a bit more writing about this. What is this all about, and where does it take us?
Well, I mean, it's a good question, because the thing with atheism plus, and if you're not familiar with this, this was an idea that was sort of envisioned by Jim McCrite over at Freethought Blogs, and has sort of been fermenting among some of the more progressive bloggers there, like Greta Christina, P.Z. Myers, and others. And the idea behind this is a form of atheism that may take the form of an organization or group or subgroup or quote-unquote movement, depending on who you ask, that is explicitly and going to be actively participating in social justice and civil liberties. Now, of course, this sounds like a good idea. Some people have said, well, wait a second, though, isn't that just secular humanism rebranded? And some people have said, well, wait a second, I call myself a skeptic, but I also think that social justice, et cetera, are really important causes. And some people have said, well, wait a second, I call myself an atheist, and I don't want my word rebranded to mean X, Y, and Z. So there's been a lot of talk about words, terminology, and how people identify themselves. Now, we can sort of debate the different levels of that argument and its meta forms. Now, my personal take, and I think that it's no surprise, we've discussed this many times here on the show, that skepticism for me, and I think Don as well, would basically include a skeptical approach to atheism, humanism, religion, politics, social justice, and everything in between, because we don't really hold back our critical thinking when it comes to discussing important topics. We make sure that when we talk about everything from gun control or decriminalization of prostitution, that we're being critical thinkers. The counter argument is, well, you know, I can take homeopathy into a laboratory and look at it under a microscope. I can examine the supposed hairs of Bigfoot. I can examine a photograph of UFOs, but I can't really drag policy into a laboratory and study it. So how can we be skeptical of social justice issues? Now, Don, what do you think about that?
Well, I think in the one sense that what you're referring to is you get a large degree of certainty when you deal with, you know, the classic sort of skeptical issues. But when you go to social scientists, you know, like I say, policy, you don't tend to get the black or white. But we've talked about on this show that there actually is a lot of empirical evidence that you can use to sort of say, well, this particular social policy is much more effective than this other social policy. And as such, we can say that in general, this is going to be better than that, even if it isn't quite as, well, this is true and that's false. It's more of a shade of gray, but there are different shades of gray, and you can make, you can use your tools to make appeals in these areas. So I think we agree on that.
Yeah, absolutely. So the problem is that there are certain individuals out there who believe that skepticism, I guess we could call it capital S skepticism, can really only be applied to certain topics of science. And that's well and good. And there are certain people out there who believe that atheism is, of course, the most important cause to investigate. Some people think that skepticism is the most important cause to investigate. Now, I mean, whether or not we agree or disagree with those kind of claims, the problem that we have right now is that instead of simply saying, okay, well, the atheist plusers are going to focus on atheism and social justice, people are getting up in arms about this. And they're saying, not only are they co-opting our word, which I think is odd in the first place, but they're damaging the movement. They're mission drift. They're splitters. They're like that skit in Monty Python. And, you know, that's bad. And my personal take on that is, are you crazy? What are you talking about? And the reason I say that is because the number one issue that every single one of us, whether we call ourselves an atheist, a skeptic, a humanist, or a bright, or whatever, is that we think the world would be a little bit better if we're a little bit more rational. And how do we get people to be more rational? Well, we convince them to be more rational, which sounds simple, and it is. Because we need people in our movement. And we need people, whether or not they identify themselves as an atheist or a skeptic, we need them. And we need them for battles of secularism, we need them for battles of skepticism. And if Atheism Plus brings in more people into our movement, that's more people who might show up at a Skeptics in a Pub. That's more people who may say, well, I've read all of Dawkins' work, now I'm going to read some of Carl Sagan's work. And that's more people who are going to say, you know, I'm coming at this movement because I'm interested in social justice, and I'm an atheist, but I don't really know anything about atheism. And they're going to read some of the, you know, really important skeptical atheist books out there, and they're going to find themselves, and they're going to say, well, I'm really on board with this movement. And rather than looking at it as a splitting or an offshoot, look at it as a bigger way to reach more people. And that's the way I'm looking at it. Now, I may not be the only person who has an opinion on this, so I'll throw things over to Don here. What do you think about that?
Well, I think we have a schism in the show, Ethan. This is one of those weird cases where, in some ways, I mean, who could really argue with some of the goals and some of the plans, practical actions of sort of the A plus movement? But for myself, I think, at least originally, and now movements will tend to take on a life of themselves and may change. But having read the blog post from Jen and those other ones, and I don't want to rehash too much here, but it was actually intended to be exclusionary, not inclusionary. It was like, well, the old movement had a bunch of these people who we think are not good people, so we're going to create a new movement and not let them into our clubhouse. And that's why I will have a bit of negative attitude towards the A+. Now, that being said, you are right. You know, I mean, the movement needs to move on. I'm not a big fan of using the term atheist for practical reasons. And forgive me for being a Scotchman on this one, if you understand the logical fallacy here. But I think atheism itself, I mean, a true atheist not only denies God, but does so because of the applications of the skeptical toolkit. That skepticism is a methodology for approaching truth, it's one of the achievements of sort of the second wave. I mean, prior to that, you know, a lot of people can be atheists, but they're not always atheists for good reasons. They're actually atheists based on faith. And again, we talked about in our bad atheists about some people who do that. So I'm not a big fan of using the atheist term in and of itself, because I think it puts emphasis on the wrong part of the movement. In fact, a lot of the people who've been causing dissension within the skeptical movement are atheists who are also racist, as well as, of course, the sexists that are in the movement. And I think, you know, that if you were a, again, forgive me for using this word, a true skeptic, then you wouldn't be able to do that because it would create a cognitive dissonance in your brain. And that, you know, if we apply the idea of skepticism to its logical ends, it would not only cure up the problem in atheism, but it would allow skepticism itself to move on. I mean, one of the things that I've mentioned before and I'm writing about is that we want to tackle all of these sort of social issues. And again, I am all for that. We have not talked about that too little on this show. But at the same time, as an internal movement, how can we honestly say, how can we honestly make recommendations about how the world should be when we within our own movement don't acknowledge the equality of people who are within our own movement? So, you know, I agree. We need a lot of work, and I like the practical actions of the A-plus movement, but I don't like the fact that it does seem to be a splintering and not an augmentation. But as I said, maybe the movement will supersede its origination and become a bigger vacuum for the people with lacking skeptical skills to come into the movement.
Well, to address some of those points, the original idea behind Jen sort of starting her own group, movement, whatever you want to call it, related to the issue that she had been trying for many years, as have others, to expand the frontiers of what skeptics talk about, whether that's talking about feminism or talking about social justice. And the resistance that she was getting was not just in the form of sort of a finger wag saying, you know, you're not supposed to be doing this or you're doing it wrong, but it was also coming in the form of really violent, aggressive behavior, menacing behavior, threats, rape threats, etc. And, you know, like, as I wrote in my post on Skeptic North about this, I don't even consider those people relevant. I don't want them in my movement. If you make a rape or death threat, bye.
And I don't think we disagree on that part.
Yeah, slam the door in their face. They're gone. So part of it was, I think, Jen and others basically said, you know what? I'm tired of being the only woman at a conference. I'm tired of trying to get people to talk about social justice. I'm tired of defending feminism and having people say to me, you know, how can you call yourself a humanist and a feminist? Feminists just hate men, et cetera, et cetera. I'm going to start a group that states as its mandate, we are going to talk about social justice. And if you're not on board with that, don't get involved. I don't have a problem with that. I don't think that's excluding. Like, because, I mean, if that's being exclusive, then every other skeptical organization that has a mandate is also being exclusive. Because CFI, for example, has the dual mandate of promoting skepticism and promoting humanism. So you know going in that if you're one of those people who say, I only want to talk about science, you're going to encounter some frustrations. Likewise, the JREF very clearly says, we are about the science. We are about the skepticism. And if you go into the JREF and say, hey, let's talk about humanism, let's talk about secularism, they're going to say, well, no, we're a skeptic organization. That's very clearly laid out. So, I mean, yes, it on the surface, it appears that Atheism Plus might be a bit exclusive, but it's no more exclusive than any of the other skeptical organizations that exist out there.
What I worry about this is that in the effort to apply genuine social reforms and using skepticism as its tool, which again, I think it's odd that they're using atheism instead of skepticism, but forgive that for the moment, that I am worried that, I mean, right now, I am worried about what I'm going to say. I mean, I have never given a death threat to someone, but I think some of the rhetoric that has gone on has been extreme and has been damaging to the movement. Not that it shouldn't have been said. It needs to be said. But it shouldn't be said as a separate entity. It needs to be said as part of the thing. I mean, how long did it take people in the Democratic Party to promote their own political agenda in the United States? I mean, the Democratic Party is now quite largely a party for blacks and minorities. But if you go back into the 50s and 40s, it was the Republicans who were like that. And you need to put up the fight. And, you know, if Jen sits there or anyone else has death threats against them, there's zero tolerance for that. But if there's someone who says, well, I don't know if we need this, or I disagree that every joke is a sexist joke and that it's not sometimes funny, there's education involved in that, because, I mean, again, that's a very gray area. But there seems to be a conflation of the extremists who do the death threats with people who are not extremists, who are just not ready to move along yet and need to be pushed along but are not there yet. And this somehow says, no, all of them, we don't want any of them in. And that's where the exclusionary aspect comes into it for me.
Yeah, but I think that exists with other groups as well. Like, I'm pretty sure that...
Well, I'll go with that. But do we need another exclusionary group?
Well, I don't see it as exclusionary. I see it as... First of all, if you're not on board with the Atheism Plus thing, then don't sign up for Atheism Plus. If you're not interested in a dual mandate organization, don't join CFI. And if you're not interested in an organization that focuses on magic and skepticism, don't join the JREF. I mean, no one's holding a gun to your head. There are plenty of organizations out there that, you know, focus on your particular focus of whatever it is you want to talk about. There are enough of them for all of us. Now, whether or not you want to join one of them or whether or not you don't want to join any group,
But doesn't that run one risk? And I say this word with some trepidation, but doesn't then we have A-plus become feminist atheism? And in that sense, it doesn't actually move the ball forward for the whole movement as a general, but it becomes sort of ghettoized.
I think it's already ghettoized. Like, I mean, if you look at the feminist bloggers who are out there, they're not just being attacked by the crazies. They're being attacked by other well-recognized and well-known skeptics. You know, it's no secret that Penn Jillette, for example, has made some really misogynistic comments about some of the female skeptics in the movement. They've been attacked by lots of different people. Like, these aren't just cranks who are sending death threats.
Hold it. I can see. Now, this is one of the things that I worry. So do you honestly think that Penn Jillette is going to go and rape the Jen? I mean, is that a serious statement? I mean, I agree. He says misogynist things. His views on women are atrocious. But that's where you get the conflation between people who are genuinely dangerous against those people who are stupid and need to grow up.
Well, what's the point, though? I mean, like, if you're saying stupid things, why do we want you around?
Because how are you ever going to learn the right things?
Well, I guess that's sort of how anyone learns, isn't it? I mean, if you go up to a group of people and start, like, slapping them and punching them, are they going to, like, sort of stand there and be like, you know, I'm sorry, this is not how you behave? They're going to be like, you know, get out of here. And you're going to have to learn pretty quickly that that's not how you interact with people.
Well, again, we're talking words, which I know words are hateful, and I'm not discrediting that. But, I mean, if Penn yells at them, she can yell at them back. And ideally, again, if they are the true skeptics, which is why I think skepticism is the place for this, one argument will definitely win out.
That's what they've been doing, though. Like, that's exactly what's been happening for the past, like, 3 years. That's elevator gate in a nutshell. And I don't think it's resolved anything.
See, and I think it has, because we're having this conversation. It's an ugly conversation at times. It's a frustrating conversation. And I understand and I can appreciate the courage and conviction it takes for people who are sort of feminist and in the movement to put up with the bullshit that goes on. And more power to them, and I can support them however I can. But every movement goes through this phase. That's all.
Yeah, okay. Well, I don't think we're that far apart on this. I think it's more of a matter of the finer points. But I think that we both would agree that some of the rhetoric that's been thrown around about this is really not worth the air that it takes up to say it. I mean, we're talking about people who are suggesting that someone who thinks that social justice can be an integral part of atheism are damaging and they're splitters and they're terrible people. I mean, that kind of rhetoric, which could very easily be applied to us. Let's be honest here. Yep. Radio Free Thinker, you know, we don't really shy away from any topic. You know, it's a pretty silly argument to be made, and it's pretty silly to hear some pretty accomplished scientists and skeptics make that claim.
And I think this comes down to one of the parts that every movement and anyone who belongs and cares about a movement has to deal with, is the fact that, you know, when you look in the mirror sometimes, you don't always see the pretty. There is ugliness in there. As a movement, we need to acknowledge they're there, and we need to move on. We need to address them before we can really actively address the external ones, because these are very important issues. I am not in any way trying to make them less. And it's sad, but every movement needs to move on. It needs to grow, and it needs to have the strength to move on, because I would hate to see this diminish. And perhaps we should pause on that. This is Don saying, eyes open, minds on.
And this is Ethan, your freethinking historian, saying thanks for listening.
If you wish to make an apple pie from scratch, you must first invent the universe.
Thanks for listening to Radio Freethinker. Remember to visit us online at radiofreethinker.com and subscribe to the podcast on iTunes. If you have any local skeptical events you would like us to mention on the air, email us at info@radiofreethinker.com.
Venture to the stars. A still more glorious dawn awaits, not a sunrise, but a galaxy rise. A morning filled with 400 billion suns. The rising of the Milky Way. The cosmos is full.
We are a flexible and innovative species, and we have the capacity to adapt and modify our behavior. Now, we most certainly have to do so if we're to deal with climate change. It's the biggest challenge we have yet faced.
The same thing that keeps the Earth warm. CO2 may make the Earth too warm. It holds in heat.
Methane, chlorofluorocarbons, water vapor, and carbon dioxide.
They all trap heat.
Methane, chlorofluorocarbons, water vapor, and carbon dioxide.
They all trap
heat. It is important that the world get together to face the problems which attack us as a unit.
The evidence is clear.
The globe is getting too warm.
We can avoid climate catastrophes.
We can do this.
We can change the world.
Science offers us answers to these huge challenges.
It's one global ecosystem.
We can do this.
We can change the world.
Every single thing every one of us does,
affects everybody all over the world.
It's one global ecosystem.
Dry. Climates all start in the sky.
Warm, wet, wind, cold or dry.
Climates all start in the sky.
When the CO2 is high, the temperature is high. Moving together in lockstep. When the CO2 is low, the temperature is low. Moving together.
It is important that the world get together to face the problems which attack us as a unit.
Evidence is clear.
The globe is getting too warm.
We can avoid climate catastrophes.
We can do this.
We can change the world.
Science offers us answers to these huge challenges.
It's one global ecosystem.
We can do this.
We can change the world.
Our use of fossil fuels for energy is pushing us towards a climate unlike any seen in the history of civilization.
Adding carbon dioxide to the atmosphere warms things up.
The rise in CO2 comes from burning fossil fuels.
When you burn them, add oxygen, that makes CO2 that goes in the air.
We're reversing the process by which they formed.
We're reversing the process.
We're talking about something that affects the entire earth. Problems that transcend nations. It is important that the world get together to face the problems which attack us as a unit.
Evidence is clear.
The globe is getting too warm.
We can avoid climate catastrophes.
We can do this.
We can change the world.
Science offers us answers to these huge challenges.